Thank you very much. And so here is my title. And as you can see, I will be talking about two things which are rather different. I was asked to give an overview of what we know about topology of protein binding networks. But I also recently worked on equilibrium and kinetics in those networks. And this is what I'm currently very excited about. And at first I thought that I will go very logically. I will first discuss topology. I will describe the, you know, peculiar properties of this topology, which many people studied, describe models. But then I realized that by the time I will get to kinetics, the effects of morning coffee would wear off, and most likely I will lose, you know, a fraction of my audience. So what I thought is I will start with some kind of overview. I will describe experimental techniques and, you know, briefly describe experimental techniques used to obtain protein-protein binding data on a genome-wide scale. And then, following a convenient kind of connection, I would go to the very recent work on kinetics and equilibrium, and then I will come back to topology. So this way I will, you know, I will not completely lose my audience on topology talk. So what I'm talking about, you know, the subject of my talk are genome-wide protein binding networks. And here is a, you know, one of the examples which comes from the, it's a C. elegans protein-protein interaction network experimentally obtained by Vidal's group at Harvard and published in Science in 2004. And this is a very representative picture because that's basically how all of those networks look like if you decide to visualize the whole network. It's just a giant hairball of proteins. So what forms those networks? The nodes in those networks are proteins or types of proteins. And since we are talking about genome-wide networks, we basically have as many nodes as there are genes encoded in a genome, or about as many. And edges in those networks are protein-protein binding interactions. And so if I see that this protein, for instance, interacts with this protein, or better, I use this kind of blow-up region where there are names. So if I see that W02A11.1 interacts with ZK858.7, that just means that somebody bothered to check whether they bind to each other or not. They found that they bind with each other, and they drew a link. So conceptually, it's a very simple object. However, it's also very heterogeneous in terms of function. And that's what makes a little bit difficult to analyze is those data sets, because what, you know, there are many reasons why two proteins could bind. There could be purely structural reasons. Let's say tubulin binds other tubulin to form microtubules. They could form some multi-protein complexes or dimers to do some work in the cell. And we know a lot of examples of those large molecular machines which do some spectacular work inside the cell. And typically what the glue which holds those molecular machines kind of prevents them from falling apart into constituent proteins are protein-protein bindings. There are also a fraction of those links which are regulatory in nature. Say some of those proteins are kinases, and kinases, what kinases do, they phosphorylate their substrate proteins. So we could see a link between a kinase and one of its substrates, and what it really means is that when those two proteins bind, there is an irreversible process where a kinase attaches a phosphate group to one of the residues of the target protein, and when they dissociate, then they are no longer the same as they were when they bound with each other in the first place. Those are, you know, what is predominantly used for regulation and signaling, for post-transcriptional regulation and signaling in eukaryotes, and it doesn't only involve kinases, there are also phosphatases and other regulatory types of proteins. And finally, we really don't know what is behind many of those links. There could be a very good link which makes perfect functional, well, which makes perfect sense in a sense that both proteins seem to belong to the same functional category, but we simply don't know why nature decided to keep them bound with each other. So there is a kind of the whole zoo of functions, and that's why when you think about those networks, you tend to concentrate on one function and forget about others. And it's a little bit dangerous, because if you say concentrate only on regulation aspects of those networks, then you forget that the vast majority of those links are actually reversible protein-protein bindings. So only, say, about in yeast network, only 5% of links involve a kinase. And therefore, it's just kind of a word of caution. So let's see how much data is out there. So this work on assembling genome-wide protein-protein binding data sets started roughly in 2000, where the first data set was published. It was for yeast. And it's no surprise that yeast is probably the most studied organism in this aspect. This table lists all the organisms for which this genome-wide or almost genome-wide information is available today. And let me just tell you what this means. HTP means high throughput. So that means that literally there was one experiment where people looked at all possible pairs of proteins encoded in the genome, and for each pair they decided whether they interact or not. So on one hand, those high throughput data sets are good because they are unbiased, so people really bothered to check all or almost all of the pairs. On the other hand, they are noisy because there is simply no way how you could reliably and reproducibly check a huge number of pairs. And LC here, PI just means protein interaction. LC means literature curated. So this is a totally different type of data. They come from a collection of many articles. So each article reports maybe a handful of protein interactions. But if you put all of those articles, all this body of knowledge together, then they could all add up to a sizable number of binding links. As you can see in yeast, the number of literature-curated data probably exceeds the number of high-throughput data sets, 20,000 edges versus 13,000 edges. And the number of sources is also quite high, 3,100 versus 5. But it's actually also remarkable that there were five groups which did the genome-wide assays in yeast as well. So for Drosophila, there were, well, according to this database, I took this table from BioGrid database, there were two high-throughput assays. For C. elegans, there was one. The only other organisms which comes close to yeast in terms of the number, actually it exceeds yeast in terms of the number of literature-curated data, is human. There are 12,000, whooping 12,000 papers. Altogether, they contain roughly 30,000 protein-binding interactions. And there are currently, very recently, there were two high-throughput assays of protein-protein binding in human, and altogether combined, they have roughly 3,500 links. There is also one prokaryote and one eukaryote, but you know, the, so they are kind of, they are also very recent data sets. Altogether, the take-home message is that we have about six data, you know, six organisms for which we have this information. In each organism, we have, with few exceptions, we have something on a scale of tens of thousands of binding links and of something on a scale of 3,000 to 7,000 protein nodes. So we have quite a lot of data. And in the next couple of slides, I describe two experimental techniques which are mostly used to do those high-throughput genome-wide assays. What is the yeast-to-hybrid technique, which was invented by Stanley Fields? Yes? Divided by the number of nodes. Well, that's a good question. You tend to say that, basically, if I understood your question correctly, you're asking how come that, well, it's not very surprising that there are a lot of people working on human because, you know, we are all funded by NIH and they are interested in human predominantly. So, but I guess your question was how come that the ratio between the number of edges and the number of nodes is much higher in human literature curated data than in high throughput one. So if you, that is actually a very important measure of network connectivity, it's just the average number of interaction partners. So here it's something on a scale of 2, and here it's something on a scale of 5, or maybe 4. So, yes, there is this, you know, there is this excess which actually goes in the opposite direction that I would have predicted, because naively I would predict that high throughput would give you more interactions than when people write papers, they only look where they expect to find things, you know, by and large. Whereas when they do an unbiased essay, then they could uncover some protein-binding interactions which were totally unexpected. So I don't know what to make out of it. I guess all these ratios in high throughput data are very subject to where you draw a cutoff, because all of those data come with p-values, and I could easily double this number if I use another p-value. So in some sense, it's not a completely honest comparison, but it's actually my understanding. Those two papers on human are yeast to hybrid. That is possible, but this table comes from BioGrid database, and luckily in this database they drop this idea that if you have a complex, you would just draw a fully connected graph of all the edges within a complex. It's still that's a good point. It could contribute to the effect, but what people used to do before, if they have say a complex formed by, I don't know, six proteins here, they would draw all 15 links between those six proteins. Of course, only a fraction of those links correspond to real direct protein-protein binding interactions. And this kind of reflects our lack of knowledge. And lately, they shifted to this scheme where they only draw edges from the protein which was used as a bait in those, affinity tag protein, which was used as a bait, to all the proteins fished out. It still contains indirect interactions, but not as many as this fully connected graph. Well, but there could be small-scale, you know, affinity tagging, which is probably what constitutes, you know, at least some. And there are also many complexes for which you simply don't have this direct binding information, right? But I would take it as an encouraging sign, because it actually means that even if we take, you know, as our fundamental belief that literature-curated data are somewhat more reliable than high-throughput ones, then the fact that we do have about five interaction partners, actually it's more, it's about 10, because you have to double the number of edges. Each edge involves two proteins, so the number, average number of binding partners in this data set would be 62,000 divided by 6,400, so something on a scale of 10, which is quite high. But, okay, so in a nutshell, two techniques which are mostly used for high-throughput assays. One is called yeast-to-hybrid technique, which was invented by Stanley Fields. What I didn't know, actually, until I read some review, that this technique was invented when he was a professor at Stony Brook University, where I am adjunct professor right now, and apparently this is the biggest, the patent which brings Stony Brook the most money currently. So Stony Brook has a patent for yeast-to-hybrid technique. The idea is very simple. They took one of the transcription factors in yeast, I believe Gal4, and the transcription factor has two domains. One binds DNA, the other one recruits RNA polymerase to activate the transcription of a particular gene. So what they did now is they separated those two domains into, you know, and then they constructed hybrid proteins. So say you want to find out whether protein A interacts with protein B. In yeast-to-hybrid technique, you construct hybrid proteins. You take protein A and attach to this protein the Gal4 binding domain. So you construct kind of chimeric protein which has an extra domain in it. And the same for protein B, except that you add activating domain from Gal4. So in order to activate, and then you have a particular reporter gene, you have a Gal4 binding domain on DNA sequence, and you have a Gal4 activated reporter gene, which you could easily detect in your system. And if proteins A and B do bind with each other, then by this act of binding, they reconstruct almost perfect, well, of course, it's not perfect, but nearly perfect copy of Gal4 transcription factor. It has a DNA binding domain, and it has activation domain. As a result, if this is the case, if protein A and B bind, then they would see some activity on GAL4 activated reporter gene. So this technique has a lot of positive things about it, because that was the first technique which allowed us to collect those data, and when it's used on a small scale, it's quite reproducible and reliable technique. However, it also has a number of problems with it, which are kind of built in the way the technique is designed. And it's important to understand those problems, because when you think about those data, you have to run in your mind this filter: what if what I see is not the result of some fascinating topological properties of the network, but simply an artifact of the technique used to get the data. So the take-home message is that the way technique works is that both proteins A and B are highly overexpressed, or they are present in typically non-functional, in quantities in the cell, which are not really correspond to their wild-type abundances. So therefore, you could, in principle, expect to see some rather weak bindings, which wouldn't be visible under normal circumstances when proteins are present in more moderate amounts. The localization of proteins is also quite often wrong, unless both proteins have nuclear localization, because in order for this technique to work, both proteins A and B has to be smuggled inside the nucleus. And as if the proteins are cytoplasmic, then in principle they operate in the environment for which they are not designed. And unless you do your experiments in yeast, even host organism is wrong. So if you do a yeast-to-hybrid study of human, you still construct those hybrid proteins in yeast, and you study how they interact in yeast. So it's almost, I would say, it's halfway between in vivo study and in vitro study, because a lot of things are not really in vivo. But the pros of this, one of the pros of this method is that it really detects direct binding events. It's highly unlikely that there would be, since both proteins are present in very high abundance, it's highly unlikely that there would be some intermediate protein, which would be typically all of the intermediate proteins would be present in much lower abundance, which could serve as a bridge between A and B. Because with all the techniques, you have to worry whether you see a direct binding or something is in between proteins A and B. So with yeast to hybrid, to a first approximation, you could be safe. You could say that what we see is our direct binding events. The main source of noise, and the thing which most experimentalists doing those experiments worry about, are self-activating baits. So this protein is called bait because it binds to a DNA and waits for its prey to come in a close proximity to be captured. So if the bait would be able to somehow recruit RNA polymerase in the absence of any preys, then you have a problem, because then you would have a random collection of preys adjacent to a bait. So that's at least, currently thought that's one of the main sources of noise in those experimental. Yes? It is possible. However, both proteins A and B are highly overexpressed. And what it means is that, they are not really at any wild-type concentrations. So I guess my point is that, if you have two elephants in the room, then there could be a rabbit which kind of mediates interaction between two elephants, but it's highly unlikely. So all other proteins are like rabbits. And then another technique which is gaining popularity, actually in yeast now it's overtook by the number of interaction links. It overtook the yeast-to-hybrid data set, which is a combination of affinity capture and mass spectrometry. So in a nutshell, what is done, they take one protein here, this open circle with a little red thing, which is a tag. The tag is recognized by an antibody. So you let this tagged protein to swim happily inside the cell to do whatever it does normally. And if it wants, it could associate the inside a large multi-protein complex, or sometimes it just has one protein binding partner, which it currently associates with. Then at some point you use, you basically capture, you make a snapshot of what is going on inside the cell. And when you make a snapshot, you basically freeze those complexes in the way they were by some, chemical treatment. Then you use antibody to fish out those complexes out of cells which are now chopped up into little tiny pieces. And when you fish out not just the tag protein, but all other proteins which are which are in the same complex. And then you cut it even into smaller pieces by, you know, by literally making the constituent proteins to break into small segments, small amino acid segments. Everything goes through a mass spec, and mass spec basically would be able to tell you the masses of those little pieces. And based on their masses, you could then reconstruct what proteins were in the complex. So it's kind of not really important. All the details of how this works or how this works are not really important for us who just work with those data. Of course, they're hugely important for people who do the experiments. However, what we need to know about this technique is that it's a real in vivo technique, because you really do a snapshot of what is going on inside the cell at a given moment. And of course, and then when you fish out a complex, then you are sure that this is a real complex in the sense that those proteins can physically bind with each other simultaneously. Sometimes when you work with two hybrid data, you don't know whether if A binds B and C, whether they could form an ABC complex, because it's quite possible that A binds with B and A binds with C using the same region on the interface. So here it's not one of your worries. So here you know that you have this complex. However, you don't know who is directly interacting with whom. So all you know is that you have this complex. And here comes the biggest con of this method, is that binding interactions are often indirect, and you, without other methods, you couldn't really detect who is direct, who is indirect. And the other, you might call it a con, but the other feature which separates two methods from each other is that here you really are highly unlikely to capture transient interactions, because sometimes some regular interactions occur only for very infrequently in the cell, and therefore, unless you were lucky to freeze to make a snapshot precisely when this transient interaction was present, you wouldn't see it in mass spec data. And YEAST2 hybrid is better in this aspect because it can capture some fairly transient interactions. And it's also important to know that yes? Yeah, they do include, because you know, this table I got from a database, and database now mixes up, you know, pure binary methods like two hybrid with more you know, multibody methods like mass spec. And what I was trying to explain here is that before, when they had a mass spec data set where seven proteins were captured in a complex, they were drawing this full graph, and therefore they were generating those huge cliques, which are, I guess, now in this, at least in this database, BioGrid, what they do, if this protein was used as a bait, if this protein was tagged, so this would be this protein, then they would only draw a link from a tagged protein to everything which was captured together with it. So in his case, instead of 15 edges, you would have only 5, which reduces the number of kind of edges in those databases by quite a bit. So the main source of noise, which is important to understand, that it's very different sources of noise in two hybrid and mass spec data. In mass spec data, it's mostly highly abundant and relatively sticky proteins, which just tend to stick to virtually any complex. So whenever they analyze the data coming from the experiment, they typically simply disregard the top, you know, 5 proteins which are present in, I don't know, 50 or 30% of all of their complexes, saying that they are non-specific partners, which are just stick to anything you throw at them. Okay. And that is hopefully something which would improve in the future, because, well, after all, the mass spec techniques are being developed. And would you say that I should trust more recent mass spec data than I?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
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 You might be able to identify a homily.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that I guess is expected. I didn't know that it's such a big problem, but I guess it is. It is a problem. I see. So, okay, yeah, it is especially dangerous for paralogs. And in Yiddish, there are quite a few paralogs. There are 3,000 pairs or so, if you count them all. Uh-huh, uh-huh. I see. All right, so here are the methods, and this is a breakup of how much those methods contribute to the current BioGrid database contents for yeast. So this is affinity capture mass spec is the technique which is I just described. This is two hybrid. You see that there are roughly, this is a total number of edges, and here we count the edge twice if it is detected by various techniques. So don't be surprised that I have more edges in the end than I presented in the previous slide, because there are, some of those edges are redundant. But you see that there are more than twice as many binding links which are now detected by mass spec with affinity capture than by two hybrid. So two hybrid lost the championship as the, at least for yeast, as the technique which contributes the most protein binding links. And the distant third is affinity capture combined with Western blot. So everything else is really insignificant. So you could forget about all other techniques to a first approximation. And so having done this kind of introduction into what kind of data are out there and what techniques were used to generate the data, let me plunge into the body of my talk. And actually, since I told you that I will discuss topological features later, I will use just a few slides as a meaningful transition to what I'm about to tell you about kinetics and equilibrium in those networks. So I will discuss number one and number two later on. But the kind of one of the striking properties of those networks is the small world property. At least, you know, I'm kind of trying to think what I would be surprised if I was working in the field when the first data were generated, and if I had the knowledge of the of what people think, then this is probably what I would be surprised the most, because naively you expect those protein-protein bind interactions to be mostly used in those molecular machines. And inside, you know, molecular machines, you tend to think that they are fairly separate from each other. So you say that, okay, this group of interactions happened in this molecular machine, this group of interactions happen in that molecular machine, and there is no reason a priori for those molecular machines to share some of the proteins and to literally be able to couple back, you know, to couple with each other. So what is the small world property? If you take a network, you take it from the database, or you take some highly curated network which you hooked up yourself, and you look up, you know, a particular pair of proteins which are not directly interacting with each other. So they are not physically interacting with each other. You typically would be able to find 2, 3, maybe 4 intermediate proteins such that, say, you pick proteins A and B. You could often find proteins C, D, E such that A interacts with C, C interacts with D, D interacts with E, and E interacts with B. So you literally can find the short paths along the network which connect nodes with each other. And that is the case for majority of protein nodes in those networks. To illustrate it more, let me show you two kind of hairballs. So this hairball comes from large-scale yeast-to-hybrid experiment, fairly noisy, and it has a lot of proteins. However, for 86% of proteins, they are all connected inside this giant component. And inside this giant component, I could find those intermediate proteins which connect protein A to protein B, they are a relatively short chain of intermediate proteins. So the vast majority of proteins are, at least in principle, coupled to each other via those short chains. So you might think that this is the case only for noisy data set and that all of those interconnections come from pure noise, which is contained and which is known to be contributing a large fraction of yeast to hybrid high throughput experiments. So let's look at a highly curated data set, which is a smaller one. And this is actually the data set I will use in the rest of my study of protein equilibrium and protein binding kinetics. So it is a curated data set. However, also 83% of proteins in this set are in this giant component, meaning that for them I could find relatively short chains of intermediate proteins connecting them to each other. Well, I know what you are talking about. After all, the original paper which reported the small world effect was exactly about it, that you could start in a network which doesn't have the small world effect, rewire just a small fraction. I don't think you could do it with 0.1%, but indeed you could do it with few percent of false positives. And I guess my answer to it would be that if this was the case, when I'm fairly sure that the small world I see in those networks is robust in a sense that the number of proteins at a given distance would grow exponentially. And in other words, well, I didn't do this precise experiment here, but there are well-documented cases where multi-protein complexes overlap, they share proteins. That is actually something which they also see in those mass spec data sets. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is that I would expect if what is going on is that as you move from a uncurated and noisy data set to a heavily curated and less noisy data set, you would expect at least the change in the fraction, you know, don't you? That you know, you don't expect that independent of how many false positives I have in the data set, I still have the same 80% of them to be in a giant cluster. And I'm also certain, even though I didn't do this experiment, that you couldn't really remove the small world effect by just removing a few hundred of links here. You have to remove a sizable fraction. Yes? Would have it unless you prepare it artificially to not to have it. Yes. Yes. Completely modular without any small world effect. Yes. Yes. Yeah, except that I don't really think that it would go as high as, you know, 83 in the sense that, yeah. You say that biologists say that it is...
I think biologists, way before,
No, but we are discussing kind of important topic, whether if in an ideal world, if I would be able to clear up all the false positives completely, would I still have the small world or not? And my intuition is that we would still have it, and there is an alternative kind of take on it, that then we would be in this ideal world where there are multi-protein complexes and protein dimers which are totally unconnected from each other, kind of. So, but let me, okay, let's leave this discussion for later. Let me take a small world as a fact, and let me see why we have to even bother to discuss it, because what? So I can connect proteins with intermediate, with intermediate proteins and forms of small chains. There were all those claims of robustness of the network based on the fact that the claims of robustness were based mostly on the intuition which is gained from the internet. So if you think about the internet and you also see the small world property, which is actually very beneficial for the internet, because if you want to send your message from point A to point B, you better have multiple channels along which you could send it, because if one of the channels fails, then the other one would take over, and so on and so forth. And so people kind of extended those arguments of robustness to protein binding networks and said that, you know, the networks are scale-free or broad, have a broad degree distribution, or they have the small world property because they need to be robust. And whenever I hear those arguments, I don't understand them, simply because if you think about what the small world property does for protein binding networks, it mostly presents a problem rather than a solution. Because if I have, unless you believe that all of the links in networks are used for signaling and the signaling has to be redundant like it is in the internet, if you now remember that most of those binding links are reversible protein-protein bindings, and therefore if you have two proteins which are in principle belong to completely different functional roles, which have this chain, relatively short chain connecting them to each other, if I change the concentration of one of the proteins, the other protein would feel the effects. And if this is true, then we have a problem on our hand, because we have a crosstalk which is totally undesirable, mostly detrimental for the cell, and the cell has to find a way either to tolerate it or to deal with it, systematically. So to me, the fact that those networks, the protein binding networks, are connected is a sign of a problem, which could be, of course, caused by the artifacts in the data, or could be a real problem which the cell has to tolerate. And in the first part of my talk, this part about equilibrium kinetics, I will try to estimate how big is the problem. So the problem, again, is that we do have this interconnected network, for better or worse. And that means that the concentrations of individual proteins are coupled to each other. If I change the concentration of this protein, I would affect neighbors, the neighbors would affect next nearest neighbors, the next nearest neighbors would affect next nearest neighbors, and so on. If everything is coupled to everything, how could the cell have a specific response to particular stimuli? How it can operate at all when everything is coupled to everything else? So that's the question which I want to understand quantitatively. And, of course, to understand it quantitatively, I couldn't just wave my hands and talk about topology. I have to do a real, systematic, numerical study of what is going on when I have a network with a given topology, with given protein abundances, with given dissociation constants of links, how it would behave in response to such perturbations. So that's what I will describe. This is a very recent work. The first part of it is available on archive, and the second one is submitted and for various reasons is not posted to archive, so it's really a cutting edge of what I am thinking about right now. And let me try to see what we are trying to do. So again, I already told it in a nutshell that I want to take a protein binding network and I want to go beyond topology. I want to assign weights to different edges given by dissociation constants. What do I need for this? I first need a reliable network of reversible protein-protein binding interactions, because it's only for reversible protein-protein binding interactions I could efficiently describe this kinetics and dynamics in just a single equation. So that is something we have, and there are a number of papers now which have their own versions of the reliable subnetwork of yeast. So we generated our own, and the visual inspection of this data set, you know, convinced me that that you know virtually all the links which I picked out of this network by pure chance made some functional sense. And the way we did it is we took this BioGrid database, and then we only kept the links, the physical interactions, which have two or more papers independently reporting them. So it's kind of, you know, a coincidence data set between different papers, between different studies. So if something pops out in multiple papers, it's sure to be more reliable than something which doesn't. Now, the next step which we need to do a more quantitative modeling of this network is we need to know the abundances of those proteins. After all, you know, we know that if we mix 100 molecules of one protein with 1,000 molecules of another protein, at best we could get around 100 bound heterodimers between them. Even if I make my dissociation constant infinitely strong, I couldn't go above 100, which is the abundance of the smallest of the two abundances of proteins. So luckily, there were three papers coming from the same group at UCSF, which, well, actually, in two papers they studied the protein abundances on a genome-wide scale in yeast. In another paper, they studied subcellular localization of proteins, again in yeast. So far, the situation is unique to yeast. I'm not aware of any systematic kind of genome-wide study of protein abundances in human or in C. elegans or anywhere else. There is? Okay, well, then it's interesting. I would very much like to get this data set from this paper. But okay, so we had this data set for yeast, and which also erases a lot of the working with this data set also kind of meets a lot of criticism, which is often presented when you describe the protein binding networks. They say, okay, protein binding networks might be true, they might not even have any, you know, or very small number of false positives, but they would happen at different times in different subcellular localizations. So if you have a protein A interacting with protein B, it's possible that A and B might interact in yeast to hybrid experiment, but they would never meet each other in vivo. They would be either localized in different compartments, or they would be expressed in totally different times in the cell cycle, or something like this. So working with this data set makes, you know, eliminates this problem. First of all, we do work with a data set of experimentally measured protein abundances at a particular condition, a rich growth medium condition. So all the proteins we deal with are known to be present under this condition in the cell. And secondly, we do kind of correct for the subcellular localization, so we do work with, you know, only with particular compartment. What we don't have, unfortunately, is a set of in vivo dissociation constants. So this is something which not only we don't have, but nobody has. High throughput techniques are simply not there yet. They might get there in a few more years, I don't know, or 10 more years, who knows. But right now, virtually there are no large-scale data sets of dissociation constants of protein-protein interactions. So this is something we have to live with, and let's hope that it doesn't matter, and I hope I will convince you that to a certain degree the dissociation constants are not that important, that you could, within a certain range, you could select them from the top of your head and get fairly reproducible results in whatever I will present next. Well, this is supposedly they work under a particular kind of steady-state conditions, the rich growth medium condition. So when you think about transcription factors being activated or repressed, you think about a cell being presented a stimulus and then some transcription factors would go up. But here what they measure is the cell operating in a steady-state regime under a rich growth medium. So there is a certain amount of averaging going on in the sense that the cell cycle, I guess, is still going on, so you do have a certain temporal dynamics which we don't capture. But so it's inevitable whenever you do some kind of a large-scale simulation, it's inevitable that there would be caveats like this. But I don't think it's such a big problem as opposed to when you think about the simulating the response of the cell to a particular stimulus, where indeed you could have situation before the response and after the response. Here it's more of a steady state thing with some cell cycle oscillations. Yes? No, again, we don't get this information from the database. If you are worried that a considerable number of links, so I have roughly 1,700 nodes and 5,000 edges, and only 5% of those edges involve a kinase. So that means that if you are worried about some of the edges being corresponding to irreversible processes like phosphorylations, then that's not something we have to worry about, because a very, very small fraction of the data set corresponds to irreversible. But I understand your point, that you're saying that when I say that, you know, I don't have the data at a resolution when I know that this particular protein is in this state, that particular protein is in another state, I simply don't have this information. So my hope is that it's... I would be perfectly okay if the majority of a given protein is in the same state. So I don't have to know exactly. After all, the abundance studies from Weissman group at UCSF just give me the overall abundance of a protein, which would include the abundance of its phosphorylated, you know, of the you know, subpopulation of this protein, which is phosphorylated on this residue, on that residue, on the other residue. So if I have a considerable fraction of proteins which are kind of in a mixed state, if you understand what I mean, that say one-third of this protein is phosphorylated on this residue, one-third is on that, under a given condition, you know, under the rich growth medium condition, then, of course, it is one more caveat which we have to worry about. So my hope is that it's not the case that the protein could be either fully phosphorylated or not phosphorylated at all. The majority of proteins are completely on or completely off, and then it's not a problem. Then I simply assume that the protein binding interactions in the database correspond to those functional ones. So let's just see how far can we get by just, you know, simulating the kinetics, the equilibrium state of this huge network, of genome-wide network. Yeah, it is the equilibrium constant. And I really assume, and I have some data to confirm it, that the majority of those interaction links correspond to reversible protein-protein binding events. But we need to get some idea of the average value of dissociation constant and of its range. So at first, after a long search of the literature, I stumbled upon a database called PIND database, which has relatively small number of experimentally measured dissociation constants. Altogether, it had about 400 constants in a variety of organisms. So if you narrow it down to yeast, it would be even smaller. That's why I couldn't really use this data set to put it on links in my network. I could only use it to give me a ballpark estimate of what is the range of dissociation constants used in functional protein-protein binding interactions, and what is the average. So when you calculate the average, you have to be very careful, because it's very broad distribution. So depending on how you calculate the average, you might get a fairly different answers. And since in all of the equilibrium formulas, which I will show you in a moment, what really enters into those formulas is the inverse dissociation constant, or association constants. That is the average which is relevant to my study, and this is what I will use. And I actually confirmed, again, did an in silico confirmation, that if I compare a network in which the dissociation constant varies a lot to the one where it is completely identical on all the interaction edges, then the best agreement would be if if I replace all the links with the same dissociation constant given by this 1 over average of 1 over k. So, the bottom line is that for whatever it's worth, the average value of dissociation constant in this data set was about 5 nanomolars. In yeast, if you calculate the average volume of a diploid yeast cell, 1 nanomolar corresponds to 35 molecules per cell or so. So it is something like this dissociation constant corresponds to something just under 200 molecules per cell in an equilibrium state. But of course, that doesn't mean that all of them are the same. That just means that, on average, and this average is heavily dominated by the ones which are very, very small. So there would be always those huge number of protein pairs which would have much larger dissociation constants simply because they are more abundant. So then, as far as the assignment of dissociation constants to links, we tried several. At first we tried a totally simple-minded and naive assignment. We say, what if all the dissociation constants are equal to each other and equal to 10 nanomolar, just to be a little bit more conservative? I doubled the 5 nanomolar range, which led to weaker binding. The smaller is the dissociation constant, the stronger is the binding between two proteins. But then we figured that we could do better, that there is a good reason to expect binding constant between two proteins to scale with their abundances. So if I have two very abundant proteins, there is no evolutionary reason for nature to use extremely tight binding here. So basically, again, there are many exceptions to this rule, but the rule of thumb is that the binding should be only as strong to achieve that the majority of the proteins are in the bound state. Okay? So we tried what we called evolutionary motivated variable assignment, in which we just took the maximal value of two concentrations. Ci and Cj are abundances of two interacting proteins, and divided by some number. So we choose number 20 simply because this way we got this 5 nanomolar to agree with the empirical data. It's not important. I'm not about to insist that there is some deep, profound reason why nature wants it to be 1 over 20. But just the important point of this evolutionary assignment is that I wouldn't have some highly abundant proteins which are present in, millimolar concentrations to interact with each other using a nanomolar dissociation constant. And vice versa, I wouldn't have some very low abundance proteins to interact with each other using millimolar dissociation constant. So it kind of gives you the right ballpark of dissociation constant. And the good news is that, as I will convince you in a couple of slides, all different assignments gave roughly the same results. So they, again, I'm not saying that they are 100% identical, otherwise it would, you would immediately caught me on lie. But you would see that the rank correlation, say, between free concentrations of proteins or between bound concentrations of proteins were as high as 0.9, which means that to the first degree in those equilibrium calculations, you could safely assume dissociation constants to be either constant or this evolutionary motivated, and that wouldn't matter much. So let me just briefly review what I mean by law of mass action. So if I have two proteins which interact with each other and form a dimer, then FA and FB are free, unbound concentrations of those proteins. So whenever those two proteins bump into each other in the right way, they do form a dimer. That's why the rate of production of a dimer has a positive term, which is proportional to the product of those two concentrations. FA is important, is unbound concentration. And also, whenever dimer is formed, it falls apart with the rate R off. So we do have a loss term proportional to R off times the concentration of dimers. In equilibrium, we expect the dimer concentration to be not to change as a function of time. So we could just write it down that DAB is equal to FA times FB divided by KAB, where dissociation constant KFB is given by the ratio of those two rates. So this is, so far, I'm just repeating the textbook things, but just so that we are on the same page. Now, in this example where I have those proteins, I know that for each of the proteins, I know its total concentration, which is could be either free or bound. And I have to write the additional mass conservation equations saying that the protein A could be either free-floating or bound to a protein B, which would give you this concentration, and the same for protein B. And then I could rewrite those formulas as the equations which give me a free concentration, unbound concentration of a protein A as a function of its bound concentration and as a function of free concentration of another partner. Yes? Well, we could, yeah, it's again one of those caveats which we couldn't simulate at the moment. If there is a strong contribution of cooperative binding, especially within complexes, then you have to kind of simulate more detailed processes where any complex has to start with some initial collision event, and then the rate at which subsequent proteins are being added to this complex would depend very much on this nucleus state. I guess Sarah would be talking about it tomorrow or something related to it tomorrow. So again, if you go deep into details, you would see that there are a lot of assumptions here. However, I will show a slide later on that I believe that by and large those multi-protein complexes are still relatively few, and by and large I would be talking about heterodimers, for which it is a good approximation if you have sufficient time to average your the state of the system over, in a sense that you, even when your diffusion coefficient is slow, if you have enough time to wait for the equilibrium to be reached, you would still have, on average, this law would still work. So it is an approximation, but it is the best we could do with the data right now. So let's just see how far we can get with this. Precisely. That's the next slide. So you have a network. I was just illustrating this on a simple-minded example of two proteins, A and B, who interact only with each other and nothing else. In a network, you have to write down this system of nonlinear equations which relate the total abundances of proteins, which I know from the experiment, to their unbound concentrations, Fi's. And as you see, Fi depends on Fj's of all of its neighbors. So it is truly a nonlinear and fairly complicated system of equations. You couldn't solve it analytically. You have to solve it numerically. Luckily, it's very easy to solve numerically because it's well-behaved nonlinear system of nonlinear equations. So all you need to do is to run through successive iterations of this formula. You first say that Fi is equal to Ci. You plug it in here, for j, of course, and then you calculate the second iteration of Fi. And in about 20 iterations, it is solved numerically. So it's no big deal to calculate the equilibrium state even on any arbitrary sophisticated network. However, it is, I want to draw your attention that the equations themselves do couple free concentrations of proteins to free concentrations of their neighbors. So that's what we will be interested in when I will be discussing propagation of perturbations. So we use the experimentally measured CIs to calculate all the unbound and all bound. Here is I didn't paste it all in red. So Dij equal to Fi times Fj divided by Kij. So I could, in one shot, calculate all the equilibrium concentrations in the network, given the set of abundances, the topology of the network, and the set of dissociation constants. Only three ingredients go into this simple-minded calculation. And here is what I get. Actually, this plot was made for the situation when all the binding links have the same dissociation constant of 10 nanomolars. This histogram is a histogram of abundances of proteins, which I got from the experiment. It ranges between roughly 50 copies per cell all the way to 10 to the power 6 copies per cell. And then when I plug it in, the program spits out the unbound abundance, which are in green, bound heterodimers, pairwise interactions, which are in red. And also in this simulation, I added a list of about 100 reliable multiprotein complexes. And again, with multiprotein complexes, there are problems, namely that you do have this cooperative binding and everything like this, which has to be taken into account properly. However, if I do it very simple-mindedly by saying that all the proteins within a complex have the same dissociation constant and there is no cooperative binding effects, then I also get this histogram of abundances for complexes. And it turns out that addition of those multiprotein complexes doesn't change much my results, which I get for heterodimers. So there is one thing that I want to draw your attention to, that there are all of those extremely low abundances, which are an artifact of me assigning dissociation constants to edges in a very simple-minded way. And here is the promised plot, which shows you that if I choose the dissociation constants, the set of dissociation constants differently, I get virtually the same highly correlated set of equilibrium concentrations. This is a set of bound concentrations for all 5,000 edges in the network for two assignments of dissociation constants. Either a constant assignment where all KIJs are equal to 5 nanomolars, or this evolutionary motivated one where the KIJ is equal to maximum CICJ over 20. As you see, especially for highly abundant heterodimers, they agree with each other rather well. Then comes this cloud, which could be fairly broad, but I also wanted to draw attention to the fact that this evolutionary motivated assignment does its work in a sense that in a simple-minded assignment, I would detect some dimers which are present in a very, very low equilibrium concentrations, which is an artifact of the fact that I assigned those dissociation constants without really paying attention to what are the proteins they are supposed to bind. In the evolutionary-minded assignment, it rarely goes below 1, which is kind of, you know, if you think about it, it's almost physiological threshold. Well, of course, it doesn't mean that I couldn't have some fractional numbers here, because there could be complexes which are bound only a fraction of the time. The same is true for free unbound considerations. The linear correlation is even higher in this case, but you see how it works, that the highly abundant ones are very well correlated. Then comes the spread. The spread is not as bad as it looks like, because still the majority of the points here, the biggest cloud is here. So if I calculate the logarithm, the variation of logarithm, I think I will have around factor 2.5 here, 2.5 here and 3.5 here, the average geometric average of the ratio between the two things. So this plot is just supposed to convince you that you don't have to worry too much about how you assign KIJs, that especially for highly abundant dimers or for proteins which are mostly exist in a free floating state, the results would be roughly the same. But now, what do we do with those abundances? They are not really precise enough to compare with experiments. So what we do now is we simulate the propagation of perturbations, which I used to start this whole discussion, that we have this network which is small world. So we have all those protein pairs which are coupled with each other via short chains of, you know, intermediate proteins. So what it means in principle is that you could have a cascading perturbation. Say what we simulate now, again, we do an in silico simulation of the following process. I take my network where I calculate the equilibrium state under wild type concentrations. Then I take just one protein and I increase its abundance by factor 2. So I simulate what if this protein under some conditions would be overexpressed by a factor 2 compared to its wild-type abundance. Then what do I expect? If I overexpress this protein, its immediate neighbors would be, more of its immediate neighbors would be sequestered into heterodimers with this protein, so there would be fewer of them left free-floating, and if there would be fewer of them left free-floating, then the second-order neighbors, some of them would be released simply because there would be fewer heterodimers between first nearest neighbors and second nearest neighbors. So some of the second nearest neighbors would go up, some of the third nearest neighbors would go down in their equilibrium concentrations. So you would have this whole chain reaction of perturbations propagating via through this protein binding network. And what I want to understand is how serious is this chain reaction? Should I worry about it when I analyze real data? Should I worry about cascading perturbations which couple equilibrium concentrations of proteins beyond just nearest neighbors? And first I have the good news. The good news is that if I do a proper averaging, I forgot to say that what do I consider to be a significant coupling? So it's a matter of threshold, of putting a threshold somewhere. So what we did is that if you calculated a twofold increase in the abundance of one protein, I used the 20% cutoff to say that if the equilibrium concentration of a protein is perturbed by more than 20%, I would call this protein to be coupled with the one which was overexpressed in the beginning. So I would have this list of concentration-coupled, how we call them, concentration-coupled proteins, which could be nearest neighbors, second nearest neighbors, third nearest neighbors, and so on. So the question is, would we have some dampening effects of when we go from nearest neighbors to second nearest neighbors and so on? And the good news is that we would. The reason why I say that it's a good news, because if we wouldn't, then we would be in trouble with the, you know, with this whole concept of small world network. How could we then have a functional modules which go up by often more than factor 2, by factor 5, by factor 10, and still do not perturb the whole state beyond recognition? So what we plotted here is a fraction of concentration-coupled proteins. Again, concentration-coupled means when I overexpress one by factor 2, the other one changes by 20% or more as a function of a network distance. And as you can see, it decays exponentially on average. So on average, if I'm talking about network neighbors which are three steps away from each other, there are less than 0.5% of them which would be sensitive to each other in the concentration sense. That, and it would be totally negligible for proteins at length 4 and 5. So there is an exponential dampening here. So I do have the suppression of indiscriminate propagation of those perturbations, which is good news. But then let's look at this table. This table lists the actual numbers of concentration-coupled pairs which at a given distance. So this table is calculated under different assignments of KIJ. This one is this evolutionary assignment, which has an average value of 5 nanomolars, constant assignment of 1 nanomolar, 10 nanomolar, all the way up to rather weak binding constants of 1 micromolars. And as you see, that even though this ratio goes down quite dramatically, the actual numbers remain high. What it means is that, say, for this assignment, which would be my working case assignment, I have about 2,000 nearest neighbors which are coupled with each other, which is no surprise. After all, nearest neighbors are supposed to be coupled. But I also have more than 700 proteins which are not nearest neighbors in the network and which are still quite sensitive to each other. So you couldn't really overexpress one of them without changing the equilibrium concentration of the other. And that was a surprise. That was, you know, something which I didn't expect in the first place. And this is something which started us to make thinking about what are those non-trivially coupled, concentration-coupled proteins. So there are kind of couple of examples which I will flash. So this is a protein which I overexpressed in the beginning by factor 2. And here is a list of all proteins which changed by 20% or more in the network. As you see, red color signifies that the free concentration of a protein went down. Green means it went up. So, you know, nearest neighbors went down. Second nearest neighbors went up. There is also this four-step chain when it went from this protein in via 1, 2, 3 intermediate proteins and hit this protein by more than 20%. And 20% might sound insignificant to you, but if instead of twofold overexpression, I would choose fivefold overexpression of this guy, then this free concentration would change by 100%, which is already noticeable. So you could have some action at a distance in those networks. It would be not really indiscriminate. It would be propagating along particular channels or conduits of perturbations. But there would be quite a number of cases, 700 or so, where this would be something you have to take into account. Here is another example. What is the typical probability of that going Yeah, it's a very good point. We'll come to it in a couple of slides, actually, that the decision, you know, in a couple of slides I will address the question of what makes particular chains of links in protein binding networks to be good propagators of those perturbations and others not. And what you, I guess, what your intuition suggested to you is exactly correct, that if you have a chain of intermediate proteins, and in this chain there is at least one protein which is mostly free-floating, then the signal wouldn't, then this perturbation simply wouldn't go through this chain. It would serve as a buffer. So in order for this to happen, all of those intermediate proteins have to be heavily sequestered, mostly bound to those, you know, to those dimers. One thing, how this figure might be misleading, you might think that the network doesn't branch very much here. Oh, yes, it does, because actually out of third nearest neighbors, maybe it's not for this figure, I don't exactly know the numbers for this figure, but for one of the figures I use in the paper, only 3 out of, say, 20 second nearest neighbors are significantly perturbed. The rest are totally insensitive to whatever is going on, to whatever is happening to this protein. Okay, so we do have a very specific propagation. That's why overall we could have this exponential decay fairly rapid, because I would have, I don't know, 30 proteins at distance 2 which didn't respond at all. But I would also have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 which did respond. Yes? Well, it depends. By definition, actually, the area of the circle corresponds to logarithm of the magnitude of perturbation. All right. So you could probably say that this area corresponds to something like 20%. So this, the immediate neighbors would be perturbed more than distant ones, and typically the immediate neighbors would be perturbed quite a bit. So here is another example. I don't know if those examples are just supposed to illustrate that I do have those chains, which are non-trivial chains along which the signal does propagate. And now I want to address a question for which Michael already revealed part of the answer. What makes some long chains good conduits for propagation while others are bad? And here it turns out that what really helps a lot is that there is actually an exact analogy of this problem of propagation of perturbations in networks to current in resistors. So once I use this law of mass action equilibrium to calculate equilibrium concentrations of all the dimers and of all the unbound concentrations of all the proteins, I could cook up a resistor network which would have properties related to the propagation of perturbations. If I assign conductivities to links proportional to dimer concentrations, Dij, and if I connect each node to a ground by a conductivity proportional to its unbound concentration, Fi, then electric potentials with this extra minus 1 to the power L would be mapped to relative changes in free concentrations, and the initial perturbation would be the injected current. So what happens is that you inject the current in the network. The network has a very heterogeneous set of resistors. It tends to flow to resistors which are, you know, which are highly conductive, for which Dijs are high. That's why perturbations would tend to select, if a protein has multiple partners, it would tend to select the partners which form more abundant dimers to the ones which form less abundant dimers. And the second thing, which is, I guess, what Michael was after, is that if you have this free concentration which is high, then you have this high conductivity to the ground which results to a loss of current, to a loss of perturbation. And so if you have a node which is mostly unbound, if Fi over Ci is close to 1, then the signal simply doesn't go through this node at all. It simply is absorbed in this node as a buffer. So indeed, once we considered 8 chains which are very good conductors of the signal, actually in this 8 chains we have, they all are 3-step chains. So the initial perturbation was in a, you know, twofold overexpression, but the change in the free concentration in the end was also 100% or more. So instead of 20% cutoff, we used 100% cutoff. So it's almost really like a lossless propagation of the perturbation via those chains. And they do have this high heterodimer concentration all along the way. They do have this very particular gradient in which the perturbation goes from higher abundant proteins to lower abundant protein, not vice versa. So it almost always those signals are unidirectional. It goes from, you know, from a protein which is present in whatever 10 to the power 5 copies per cell and end with a protein which is present about average in the cell. All of those dashed lines are geometric averages for all the for the corresponding properties all over the network. And the third thing is that indeed the intermediate proteins have to be highly sequestered. The Fi to Ci ratio has to be below what you expect in all over the network. So those all kind of three points are what you expect from this resistor network analogy. Perhaps just to give you a little bit of a visual picture of what is going on, here is a subset of proteins with all the connections between them. So you see this hairball with a lot of kind of intermediate connections. First, I did the law of mass actions equilibrium simulation, and I singled out among all of those heterodimers the ones which are highly abundant. By highly abundant, I mean present in 1,000 copies per cell or more. And instead of this whole zoo, here I'm left with a relatively small number of clusters. Those clusters have those pronounced linear features like chains along which the concentration signal could propagate. And what I will convince you in the next slide, so between those two slides, I didn't do any perturbation analysis, just the equilibrium, the law of mass action equilibrium calculation. Then I will convince you that it's indeed along those chains that the signal is mostly flowing. Then here, I do show all the pairs of proteins which are concentration coupled in the sense I presented above. Now, all of a sudden, what used to be an undirected network became a directed network because of this gradient effect that the signal goes from high to low and not vice versa. And as you see, to a large extent, not completely, but to a large extent, those two pictures coincide with each other, which confirms the intuition which you get from this resistor network analogy that perturbations do select highly abundant heterodimers to low abundant ones. So a priori, if I didn't know anything but the topology, I wouldn't know what is important in this zoo and what is not. Now I do know that this is this subset of highly abundant dimers. And the good news is that the set of highly abundant dimers is not particularly sensitive to the value of dissociation constant. As you saw several slides before, I guess it will take me a while to get there. Yeah. You see, if I'm talking about abundances above 10 to the power 3 copies per cell, then I'm kind of cutting off this plot here. So I would have virtually the same set. Well, this 10 to the power 3 is exactly the transition where the noise starts to kick in. So if I, instead of 10 to the power 3, if I selected something like several folds higher, I would see only those dimers for which I have a very good agreement between different choice of dissociation constants. Okay, so I guess I made my point about the fact that in principle, let's discuss implications of what we saw. So the good news is that we demonstrated that there is no indiscriminate crosstalk, that this concentration coupled pairs on average exponentially decay with the distance, which means that you don't really have to worry about this small world property when you think about how those networks function. However, the absolute number of concentration coupled pairs is large, and whenever you try to interpret the results of some response of a cell to, say, external stimuli in which levels of multiple proteins are shifted fivefold, tenfold, you have to think about possibility of those perturbations cascading down the protein binding network, which could actually, contributions from different proteins could either magnify or cancel each other. And so in principle, our results could be used to extend the list of perturbed proteins as they are measured in microarray experiments. The second application is for genetic interactions. It's actually, I didn't mention that all those databases are quite often mix genetic and physical interactions. So you have to separate them almost by hand, but well, in a good database, they would be clearly separated. By genetic interaction, I mean something of the following type. Suppose you remove a protein A, and the cell acquired a mutant, some particular bad phenotype, then if you can restore a good wild-type phenotype by overexpressing a protein B, then you say that proteins A and B are coupled, genetically interacting with each other, and the genetic interaction is of a dosage rescue type because you increase the dosage of B and you rescued the wild-type phenotype. So what we claim is that a good fraction of those genetic interactions could be attributed to this concentration coupling effect. So if you take the same BioGrid database, we have roughly 800 pairs of rescued proteins, and for 18% of them, which has an astronomically low p-value, we did find some putative protein C with the following properties: that this protein C has to be concentration coupled to both A and B. And this is what you expect. So if you expect the protein C to be the one whose equilibrium concentration has to be guarded very carefully by the cell, you knocked out A, you perturb this protein, then you overexpress B, and you partially corrected this perturbation of the equilibrium, so the protein C acquired its near wild-type level, and then everything is fine. This figure is a good kind of visualization showing that this concentration-coupled effects and the interplay between the concentration-coupled effects and genetic interactions is not limited to nearest neighbors. This is a fraction of genetic interactions among pairs of proteins which are at a given distance in a physical interaction network. So expectedly, this number is high for nearest neighbors, for immediate binding partners. But it also higher than average for proteins at distance 2 and at distance 3, if you believe that the background is here. If you naively calculate the background, then it would be here, so then this over-representation is not that significant. So I have to really rush through because I do want to give you some topology talk as well. So we also thought about what our results applied to noise. So far I was talking about large concentration changes when one protein changes twofold and then you see how it perturbs. But in a cell, all of those concentrations are subject to stochastic noise. You know, the proteins sometimes are a little bit more expressed, a little bit higher quantity, a little bit lower quantity. There would be a huge deal of cell-to-cell variability and temporal noise in all of those total concentrations. And our algorithm allows you to translate the total concentrations into biologically relevant bound or free concentrations. And what is also interesting, I really don't have the time to dwell on it, but we get quite different results for intrinsic and extrinsic noise, which is what a lot of people studying noise are concerned about. So this is for extrinsic noise, where all the protein abundances change in sync, and this is for intrinsic noise, where they change totally out of sync with each other. And what is measured here is plot free concentration versus the magnitude of noise in free concentrations of protein. So it's kind of extrinsic noise in total concentration is translated into noise in free concentration via our equilibrium calculations. It could be also possibly used for signaling. There is a known case of this being used in bacteria. I don't know any eukaryotic cases, but I would be very interested if what we find as long cascading changes is one alternative mechanism of signaling which could be used in addition to this catalytic mechanisms like phosphorylation or proteolytic cleavage or something like this. In bacteria, it is known that sigma factors, which are functional when they are bound to the rest of RNA polymerase, all of them but the one which is used under normal conditions are typically produced, then kept inactivated by reversible binding to anti-sigma factors. Some of those anti-sigma factors, which are just proteins whose only job in the cell to keep sigma factors sequestered, some of those anti-sigma factors have anti-anti-sigma factors, so that anti-anti-sigma factors are used to reversibly attract some of the anti-sigma factors to themselves, release some of sigma factors, so that they can now join the RNA polymerase and do the transcription. So you see that the three-step cascade of this type is being used in bacteria. I don't know if it's being used in eukaryotes at all or not. So now back to topology. I probably will try to wrap it up quickly, but So the thing which people started to notice once they generated the first and the second high throughput data set is that if you look at the distribution, at the histogram of the number of neighbors of individual proteins, you would see something like this. I took this plot from a recent PNAS paper because I was too lazy to generate it myself. But what is plotted here are all seven organisms for which the high throughput data exists. And actually, I think they only took the part of the data set which is generated by the yeast to hybrid data. And they plotted the histogram. How many proteins are out there which have precisely one binding partner? Well, they normalized it. So what fraction of proteins in the cell has precisely one binding partner? What fraction of proteins in the cell have precisely two binding partners, three, and so on? And all the way to some hub proteins which has something on a scale of several hundred of binding partners. So in all of those organisms, they did see that it's unusually broad, which raised some questions about whether those hubs are real hubs or they come from artifacts of experimental technique. But still, even if you work with reliable data sets, you might not see those astronomically large hubs of several hundred, but you still see quite a bit of heterogeneity in the number of interaction partners. And so it's in principle interesting question to ask what's behind this broad distribution of number of partners of individual proteins, which seems to be fairly reproducible in all of the organisms. So there are currently three explanations of this phenomena, three models which attempt to explain this observation, and they are on the market. So one, I kind of grouped them, three basic types of models, which within each category there are fine gradation of models. So one is purely evolutionary. They are kind of toy models in which proteins duplicate and the duplicated pairs subsequently diverge from each other in terms of their network topology. Then there is a biophysical kind of interpretation, which is probably most applicable to yeast to hybrid data sets, which interprets this heterogeneity in a number of partners in terms of relatively low heterogeneity, well, in terms of these differences in stickiness of proteins, which could be, for instance, due to different surface hydrophobicities of proteins. And then finally, there is a kind of functional model by saying that if those protein binding links are functional, then ultimately you need as many functional links as necessary to perform this function. So ultimately, it is possible that the hubs are out there because some functions require a protein to have many partners, while others require very few. So I wouldn't call it really a model, but rather a statement of the fact that there could be also some built-in heterogeneity and complexity of different functions. So let's review them one at a time. So the duplication divergence models are quite old. In fact, they were first introduced in this paper, which is ConMat, August of 2001. And just to remind you, the first experimental data for yeast came in 2000. So it's less than it's probably about a year after the publication of the first data set. And so this group proposed a simple model in which proteins randomly undergo duplications. And when a protein duplicates, initially it carries all of its binding links with the duplicated copy carries all of the binding links. Like in this network, you have a network, and this green protein was randomly duplicated to become a copy of it became a red protein. Initially, they had identical set of partners, green and red. And then after some time, which in those models was actually a very brief time after the duplication, so it wasn't really time resolved, some of those interaction links are lost. And in this case, you see that this red protein lost the ability to interact with the black protein. Here, what I denoted it as a dashed line means a lost interaction, which wouldn't be counted in a protein data set. It turned out that in spite of its total simple-mindedness and obviously being a complete toy model because it doesn't describe the function of why this duplication was happening in the first place and so on and so forth, those models were quite efficient in capturing the degree distribution and some of the higher-level topological properties of those networks. So they became immediately popular. They were also simple so that statistical physicists working in the field could quickly generate many versions of them. It turned out that these models were independently reinvented almost a year later by this group. This is a ConMed, which I'm personally aware of, which cites this ConMed as something which came to their attention after they finished this work. So, you know, I know the people there are totally respectable people, so I'm sure it's just independent reinvention of the same idea. And then a lot of papers followed, and I just singled one of them because it was mentioned in Hervé's talk as the only source of the, you know, of the inspiration for those models. It's relatively recent, FISREF letters, 2005, by some of my collaborators. Yaroslav Ispoladov is the guy with whom we worked on this kinetic simulations of protein binding networks. So the two conditions which I personally, well, rather the second condition I personally learned from Hervé when he was here, so that's why I give the credit to this very recent preprint from this group in Paris, that I always knew that the network has to grow to generate the scale-free distribution. I didn't know that there is a clear-cut requirement for the divergence to be asymmetric. In other words, if you do things perfectly symmetrically between green and red protein, you would get something different than a good scale-free or, you know, almost scale-free distribution. So there has to be, one of the proteins has to be, say, losing interaction partners more frequently than the other. So the models are okay, but are there actually empirical facts to confirm that this is what is going on in protein binding networks? And what would be a smoking gun for this type of behavior if we analyze pairs of paralogs present in genomes and look at how many common interaction partners they have? So if something like this is going on, then you expect to have the pair of paralogs, like those duplicated pair, to share quite a few of their interaction partners. So if we can detect the signal like this, then we know that something like this is going on in the network. Maybe it's not the only process, but it's one of the processes which contributes to shaping up the network. And I guess I forgot to mention here, it's probably obvious to most of the people in the audience, but still, the reason why this mechanism generates those hubs, the highly abundant proteins, is because, let's say, this is one of the little hubs in this network. It has four interaction partners, whereas everybody else has fewer. So the higher is the number of interaction partners you currently have, the higher are your chances that one of your interaction partners would undergo a duplication. So even in a null model world, this duplications happen totally independently. If you are a hub, you are more likely to increase your number of partners by one. So that is what is behind this mechanism generating fairly broad degree distributions. And so let's talk about empirical, you know, observations. So let's look at all the pairs of paralogs encoded in several genomes. When we did this work, which was published in 2003, one of the authors was Kunqiu Yan, who is here in the audience, and me and Kim Snappen and Kasper Eriksson. There were only three large-scale data sets, yeast and E. pylori, and towards the end of this work came another one, the fly one. So what we calculated is, so for each of the paralogous pairs, you have the amino acid sequence identity, which ranges between, say, 100% and something like 25%, below which it simply is impossible to separate truly duplicated pairs from randomly selected pairs. So, and this could serve as a, you know, as a rough estimate of time since duplication. Actually, for time, you better use the silent substitution rate, which was used by Wagner and by us in this paper in another plot. But basically, what I want to show you is that those protein pairs which duplicated fairly recently and are still or highly conserved, and they have the high sequence identity, they also share quite a lot of common interaction partners, much more than you expect by pure chance. Those dashed lines of a corresponding color correspond to what you expect for randomly selected pair of proteins, not paralogs, but just randomly selected pair of proteins. And as you see, in all the data sets at our disposal, there was a clear evolutionary signal of this type. More than that, we saw how this chances of having a common interaction partner goes down with sequence identity. And we were initially very rejoiced of seeing this plateau, because this plateau made perfect functional sense to us, that you could roughly change something like 20% of your amino acid sequence, of amino acids in your sequence, without really affecting much your set of interaction partners, because there are so many of the kind of neutral amino acid substitutions which you could do without changing the protein-protein binding domains, you know, the relevant residues in the protein-protein binding domains. So what we thought is a total kind of a rule in those networks is that this probability to share an interaction stays constant down to maybe 70% and then starts going down. Even the most distant protein pairs still have more partners than expected by pure chance. Then came the fly data set where we, no matter how hard we looked, we couldn't find this plateau. So we don't really have the explanation where it's something about the fly data set or it's something wrong with our overall intuition. But still, you know, it's undeniable that in all three data effects there is highly statistically significant signal which shows that duplicated proteins share a lot of common partners, much more than you expect by pure chance, which is what you expect in duplication divergence models. I have to be fair, I have to mention that this plot was pioneered by Andreas Wagner in 2001 in this MBE paper, where he brought also a small world concept into protein binding networks and did a lot of seminal contributions. However, since he worked with this evolutionary times KS, he worked with much smaller set of paralogs, something on a scale of 300, or whereas here for yeast we have nearly 4,000 pairs of paralogs. So we were able to get more statistical significance in our results and see a clear trend here. He saw just, you know, a couple of points which were showing the same trend for very recent duplications and intermediate duplications, and then above a certain point it all fell to the background. However, so here comes a little bit of a doubt whether indeed this duplication divergence contributes to those networks to such an extent to generate hubs. So this is a plot which I borrowed from Johannes Berg, Michael Lasik, and Andreas Wagner paper, where they argued that if this is what is behind the generation of hubs, then you would expect hub proteins in the network to have more of duplicated pairs among their neighbors than low connected proteins. After all, it is duplications which generate hubs. So instead they saw something which didn't have any pattern, or if any pattern, then it would be negative, that the connectivity, and this is fraction of duplicated pairs, if anything it goes down and not up. So the question is whether it is true that the duplications and divergence generate hubs. I don't know the answer. I know that we played with similar plots for a while. Then we realized that if you remember that duplicated pairs, you could only reconstruct the fact that this given pair is duplicated for a certain amount of time, after which it diverges beyond recognition. So when we tried to play with models in which this, we had a finite lifetime of our ability to reconstruct duplicated pairs, and then we tried to see something similar to this plot in this simple-minded model, we also saw no signal as a function of k, which might still mean that duplication divergence models might still be okay after all. Okay, if I want to finish it, I need to go quickly. So what is the next kind of group of explanations proposed for this existence of hubs, for this heterogeneous distribution of degrees of proteins? It also started with some early paper by Caldarelli, Capocci, Paolo de los Rios, and Nunes, which was published in PRL and was mostly ignored by biological community, even though they made a point. This paper was a network paper, not purely bio-network paper, but in the end of the paper they made quite a big deal saying that their results could be applied to protein binding networks and could account for observed degree distribution protein binding networks. Then the model was independently reinvented by a group of Shakhnovich and published just now in PNAS. There is another paper which was more aware of this one and were inspired by Shakhnovich to do a little bit more detailed biological analysis of what is going on. So in all of those papers, the basic mechanism for generation of hubs is the following. Nodes, protein nodes, have a certain intrinsic stickiness, let's call it SI, When I say stickiness, I put it in quotation marks because it doesn't necessarily mean hydrophobicity, even though hydrophobicity is a large kind of part of it. But it could be also other factors. The stickiness itself doesn't have to have a broad distribution. It could be distributed according to a Gaussian or exponential. However, if you now play with the following simple-minded mechanism for generating what you might call non-specific interactions, even though they could be also a mechanism for specific interactions, if you decide whether to draw a link between proteins I and J, so you look at their stickiness parameters, Si and Sj, take the sum of those two parameters, Si plus Sj, and draw this link with a certain probability which you calculate as a function of this sum. And the function in this model was taken simply to be a threshold function. So if the sum of stickiness parameters exceeds a certain threshold, you draw a link. If it's below, you don't draw a link. In more refined and biophysically inspired formalism of this paper, they use this form, which is actually sounds a lot like probability to detect a pair of proteins bound to each other given the value of dissociation constant. So this has some biophysical kind of arguments in favor of this formula. And in all of the papers, they were able to very nicely reproduce the degree distribution, and not only degree distribution, but also higher order topological, purely topological properties of networks, such as degree-degree correlations and clustering coefficients and stuff like this. So, and an important thing which distinguishes this model from the earlier duplication divergence model is that network doesn't have to grow. That this mechanism was initially proposed to as a kind of to balance a little bit all this crazy about preferential attachment by saying that it's not true that the network absolutely has to grow to have some broad degree distribution. So here is a simple-minded mechanism which doesn't, you know, which exists for stationary networks and still gives you the right phenomenology. So again, you know, there are several experimental, empirical evidence in favor of this mechanism, and I will, you know, since I give this talk, I will present the one which we obtained and published in 2005, about a year before this Shakhlovich paper, and in part, you know, he clearly kind of this idea contributed to his way of thinking about this, about those networks. So what I'm saying here is that suppose you have a certain number of so the first observation we made in this paper is that there are just too many dimers in all of the protein interaction networks in all organisms. This is a number of homodimers, self-interacting proteins in networks in yeast, worm, fly, and human. This is how many you expect under some very naive null model in which the probability of a protein to interact with itself is given by the average degree of a protein divided by a number of proteins in the network overall. So it's as if, you know, you have k links and you could send them anywhere. What are the chances that you will send them to yourself? That's k average over n. And so the overall number of dimers is n times probability of a given protein to interact with itself. So it's something like the average degree of a protein. And as you see, there are, you know, several orders of magnitude difference between how many dimers are out there and how many you predict based on a simple-minded model. And of course, it's not surprising because dimers have many functional roles, very important functional roles. Sarah knows all about it, and I don't know if you cover it in your talk, but you made a paper about, okay, altogether different. But anyhow, even naive physicists who just entered the you know, molecular biology knows that, for instance, transcription factors often act as homodimers, and so many other, you know, cases where homodimers are involved in something functionally important. So at first it was kind of moderately interesting that, well, there are many dimers. More than that, we also saw that dimers on average are more connected, twice as connected as the average protein in the network. So not only there are many of them, but they are also a little bit more connected. So far so good, but where is the stickiness in it? And that is where we generated the following plot. We decided to see if, since we had a lot of data, so we decided to see whether there is any correlation between the number of neighbors, the number of interaction partners of a protein, and the its probability to interact with itself. Basically, we bind all the data into groups based on k, the number of interaction partners, which in this fly data set ranges between roughly 1 and roughly 90 or so. So each point here is a bin of all the proteins with the degree approximately equal to, you know, within this bin. And then we calculated how many of the proteins in a given bin are also, based on the same data set, are self-interacted. And what we saw is a clear, undisputable linear pattern here. So this is a log-log plot, and this dashed line has a slope 1. Okay? So which literally means that if you have many interaction partners, you are also much more likely to interact with yourself. However, the slope of this line, not the logarithmic slope, but if I drew it on a linear scale, I would see that this probability of a protein interact with itself is roughly 0.003, whereas the probability to interact with a given randomly selected protein is only 0.0002. So there is a factor 15 here, which makes the protein more likely to interact with itself than with randomly selected protein. And what it means is that there seems to be some underlying parameter which tells you how interactive or sticky is a protein. And it's the same parameter which is being used for interaction with others and for interaction of a protein with itself. Then we got a really interesting one for human. For human, not only we saw the same kind of linear trend, but we also saw a saturation. So apparently, based on our data set, which could be an artifact of our data set, all the proteins which had more than, 90 or 80 partners were also self-interacting proteins. So it saturated according to this simple-minded formula, basically, as if you have k links, and each link has a certain probability, p self, to end up on your own, on yourself. So the probability that none of those k links would end up on yourself is 1 minus p self to the power k. So this is a probability for you not to be a dimer. So the probability to be a dimer is this. And this formula has a linear slope as a function of k in the beginning, and then it saturates seemingly exactly like you expect in real data. So for whatever it's worth, there seems to be some parameter which we call in this paper stickiness, but we immediately corrected ourselves by saying that, well, there are many factors which could contribute to stickiness: the number of hydrophobic residues on the surface, protein abundance — you expect more abundant proteins to interact with more partners and also more likely to interact with themselves. Popularity, especially in networks which come from many small-scale experiments, something like P53, where everybody is working on, and surely somebody would report that P53 is self-interacting. I don't know if it is, but it must be. It's a tetramer. Okay, here is my point. So, what I want to say is that this linearity of K is actually quite interesting, because in a random network, not only you expect much fewer dimers, but also if you make the same plot, you would expect K square. Because in random networks, to form a dimer, you have to select two kind of edge stubs and connect them to each other. Since the protein has K stubs, the probability that you would two times select the stubs from the same protein goes as K square, not K. So there is an interesting thing here as a K. So again, this is an empirical evidence in favor of those models. If you want to know more, read the Eugene Shachnovich paper or talk to him. He will be here next week. Something like this certainly happens. So functional explanation is, as I told, it's not really an explanation at all. It's just a statement that, well, if we are really sure in our networks, then each protein has as many binding partners as needed for its function. So, but then, of course, it's shifting the question to the question of why functions are so heterogeneous, why some functions require you to have, tens of partners, while others require you to have, while the majority require you to have only one or two. Second thing is that it's difficult to check, because a lot of function of those binding interactions is poorly understood. So you couldn't really see if something which looks like a perfectly plausible physical interaction between proteins, at least they are in the same functional category, but whether it's being used for something or not is hard to tell. However, if you look at some other networks like transcription regulatory network, especially in E. coli, then I think that this explanation should dominate anything else, because if you look some CRP to have 70 targets, it's because it's a global regulator of the sugar of metabolism of different sugars. So I guess it only makes sense that it has to have a lot of partners, because that's what the bugs eat. So, and for a lot of those hubs in more better understood networks, you could make a case that, you know, the hubbiness is just how important this protein is to a given bug. And of course, what I also wanted to say is that this explanation doesn't exclude the previous two, because evolution by duplications combined with pure biophysics like stickiness could provide raw materials from which functional interactions are selected. So what could happen is that those two mechanisms contribute to kind of heterogeneity of K, and then evolution selects from this heterogeneous K, and what it ends up with is also something very heterogeneous, which has traces of both this and this. So I guess on this note, I really want to end, because I don't want to bore you with the higher order correlations here. I really overestimated. By this time, you already forgot what I told you about the equilibrium calculation, so I also don't want to dwell on it. So I guess it's time for lunch. Thank you. Yes, we did this experiment. Indeed, what we saw is that if you keep the topology by randomly reshuffle abundances, we do lose long chains, at least a considerable fraction of them. We see that the long chains are, well, and you also see that in randomly reshuffled networks, there is the perturbations decay even faster. So if anything, this network is less robust. If this is a measure of robustness, it's less robust than what you get by just randomly reshuffling. One has to remember also that if you reshuffle, you lose correlations between abundances of interacting proteins, and this is a strong signal in this network. It's by strong, I mean that if you plot the rank correlation of abundances of interacting proteins, you get something like 0.35, I believe, but the p-value is astronomically low, which means that indeed abundances are coordinated in such a way that interacting proteins tend to have comparable abundances, which makes this propagation easier. Yes? It's a very good point. Actually, that's what I was trying to make when I was saying that the way we intend to apply our results is, say, what we really could do, even this we couldn't do perfectly because simply there is not enough data, but what we could do is to simulate what happens if I perturb this protein or that protein, the abundance of this or that protein, and then how the equilibrium would shift. But of course, by doing this, I ignore all the other mechanisms, regulatory mechanisms, which, you know, I will need infinitely many more parameters to describe. So still, what I do is useful in the following sense. Suppose you have a microarray, and the microarray tells you that the expression level of this gene went threefold, this gene went down twofold, and this gene went up twofold also. They have three kind of sources of perturbation. which I could plug into my equilibrium calculation. And assuming, of course, here is a big caveat again, that I have to assume that the changes in expression levels correspond to changes in protein abundances until somebody is smart enough to do, you know, well, people are already smart enough, but it's not being used on the same scale as microarrays to do the protein abundance chips, then that is the best I could do. But all I'm saying is that what I will then, given the abundances, whatever the mechanism which establish protein abundances, which could be complicated, and a lot of them, including, you know, degradation, selective degradation, transcriptional, post-transcriptional regulation, and many others. But given the abundances, I could calculate the equilibrium. And therefore, I could say that in a given microarray, I could estimate how much the equilibrium would shift, given that this is how the system decided to respond. I could roughly kind of add up those contributions from those, say, five genes. One went up fivefold, the other went down twofold, the other went up. So I could, again, simulate and combine those effects into one. But right. Yeah, but luckily the ones which are perturbed little based on microarray would also not contribute a lot to this equilibrium shift which I add up. I have a separate experiment in which I, instead of doing a microarray study, I do the noise study where I randomly perturb each abundance by, say, 20% and see which proteins respond a lot to this noise and which proteins respond very little. This is more like what is going on if I have a, you know, an ensemble of cells, each with slightly different pattern of abundances. But I guess I could reliably separate the, say, again, I wouldn't tell you exactly where to draw a line in your microarrays. You could try drawing it, and, you know. But then once you draw a line, you would be still dealing with at most 10, 20 proteins which change their expression level, which are easy to plug into my simulation and tell you how this overall equilibrium would be shifted. So again, what I'm able to tell you, you give me total abundances of proteins, no matter what is the regulatory mechanism which generated those abundances. I classify them as either free-floating, you know, either unbound or bound, and for bound, I will tell you how much is bound to this one, to that one. And of course, my work would be a lot easier if I knew the dissociation constants, but I don't.